Program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on April 25. It's my pleasure to join you here in Campbell Hall, WILL AM 580. Before we go to our guest today, I just want to say a thank you from myself and from Victor Picard, our producer at Media Matters. Last week, as I think many of you know, was Pledge Drive week here at WILL AM 580, and we were doing our fundraising. And a week ago here on Media Matters, we had an opportunity to reach out to you asking for support. And in my shameless manner, I spent 55 minutes humiliating myself to try to get you to send in your pledges. And it seemed to have worked. In fact, it was a huge success. By the latest count, just talking to one of the directors here at the station this morning, in our hour last week, we raised something along the lines of $9,000 from over 70 or 80 callers. And to give some sense of how successful that was, overall, I believe the station raised $161,000 in 8 days. And in 1 hour, we raised over 5% of that money. Had that rate held for the entire thing, it would have raised probably well over $1 million. So I can't tell you how happy that makes Victor feel, makes me feel, how delighted we are. The show of support you've given us here on Media Matters. And I was told by the head of the fundraising department here at WILL that that was the best single hour in the history of WILL radio that we had a week ago here. So again, thank you all. It's really great to know as we get up and put the show together that it has an audience, that it supports it, and it supports non-commercial and nonprofit radio broadcasting here in central Illinois. So let's go to today's show on that note. Today we've got, I think, a really terrific show for you. Our guest is the author of a new book, which is going to be one of the major works, I think, in media for the coming years. It's going to be a foundational study. His name is Paul Starr. He's the professor of sociology at Princeton University and the co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. His book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction and the Bancroft Prize in American History. His new book, which I've already referred to, is The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications, just published this year by Basic Books, available in fine booksellers everywhere. Paul Starr, are you there?
I am, and thank you for that terrific introduction.
Well, well-earned. I've had the pleasure of reading your book over the last couple of weeks, and it's a real honor to have you on the show. When I started doing this program a couple of years ago, one of the reasons I wanted to do it is because I think there is important research being done by scholars in the university pertaining to important public issues that affect us around media that oftentimes the general public is not made familiar with. And I wanted to use this show periodically as an opportunity to expose listeners to some of the best work, and that's why you're our guest today.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you know, I think the way I framed the show before we went to the news from NPR today, Professor Starr, was that most people think, when they think about the U.S. press system and media system, that it's the result of entrepreneurship and market competition. And the genius of the American system has been that the government played no role at all except to stay out of it. That when the First Amendment to the Constitution was passed, the genius of it was it said basically Congress shall make no law, later extended to government should do nothing whatsoever to interfere with the operations of commercial interest in directing the press system of the United States. Your book, I think, is safe to say, challenges that view. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, I think that is so. What I try to show is that there have been very important positive interventions, in part. I mean, there are also some negative ones, but there have been some very important positive ways in which politics has promoted the development of communications in America. And this goes back to the founding of our country. And here I put particular emphasis on the way the postal system was set up. And I think in many ways you can see the post office as having been a way of carrying out the underlying aim of the Bill of Rights. Now, so the First Amendment said Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or the press. But the year after adopting the Bill of Rights, Congress went one step further. It established a structure for the post office that really actively promoted a free press and a highly decentralized local press. And I think it's very important to remember when we think about the issues that we face today, this legacy from the founding of our country. So just to explain this a little bit more, I mean, this all happened at a time when in Europe there were very heavy taxes on the press. People may remember from studying American history that the English wanted to impose a stamp tax on the colonies, and this is one of the events leading up to the Revolution. And it wasn't just that this was taxation without representation. It was a tax on newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that led to a close alliance between the printers and the revolutionary cause. And I think it's one of the things that elevated freedom in the press into a very high value in America.
You know, when you just to interrupt for the sake of listeners who aren't familiar much with the post office, I know you're about to go into this.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what a lot of people are unaware of, and I certainly was before I studied it and before I read your book, did some other research, is the significant role that the post office played in the press system, how really it was almost interchangeable with the press system in the early republic.
Absolutely. How did news circulate in early American history? This is before the telegraph. Well, it circulated through the post office. And so it was absolutely crucial that from the beginning, newspapers, first of all, enjoyed an absolute right to be circulated by the post office.
Without discrimination against content.
Right. That's fundamental. But more than that, at the time, again, the Europeans were taxing the press, the United States decided to subsidize newspapers. And we subsidized newspapers in several ways. First of all, there were very cheap rates for newspapers to send copies to subscribers. And second, newspapers could exchange copies among each other for free. And that meant that you could get your news if you ran a little local paper, which most of the papers were small local papers. You got your news through this network operated by the government, but with this right of free exchange. So it was a government-subsidized news network, but without the government actually controlling the content of that news.
How extensive was this government subsidy of the press system through postal subsidies?
Well, it was very substantial, so that, I mean, if you look at the volume of material that went through the post office as of, let's say, the 1830s, by weight, it's over, I think I cite the figure, like 90% of the volume by weight consisted of newspapers,
mm-hmm.
with a very large percentage. It's in my book, but I can't recall it at the moment now, a very large percentage by item going through. And so, in effect, the government was charging more for correspondence, private correspondence, which was predominantly commercial correspondence,
mm-hmm.
in order to subsidize newspapers, which at that time were mainly political. And mm-hmm. so it was really emphasizing the importance of the distribution of political news nationally. And I think there were a number of motivations here. One was a concern for what we now call nation building, for creating a sense of identification with the government as a whole, with the nation as a whole. And you have to remember that at the very founding of our country, there was a real question as to whether this republic could hold together, spread over such a wide territory. There was no precedent for it in all of history. So that was one motivation. But another motivation was a concern to preserve a republican form of government. And the post office became the way, subsidizing newspapers, which were the means that political parties kept in touch with their constituents. They weren't all, but a very large number of them were partisan newspapers started by political parties in order to win elections.
We're talking to Paul Starr today, the author of the brand new book, The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communication, published by Basic Books. It's just come out. Professor Starr teaches at sociology at Princeton University, and he's the co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, a political journal I suspect many of our listeners are familiar with, and I want to talk about the American Prospect later. If you'd like to call in and speak with Professor Starr, the number is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Professor Starr, so we have huge subsidies to spawn a free press or a diverse press, a political press in the first few generations of the republic. But, you know, the post office certainly changed since then. I mean, but today we have a free market system, don't we? That's really sort of ancient history, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is ancient history, I suppose. But I think it's still important. I think it helped to set in motion certain things. For example, the newspapers in the United States grew up on a local basis, so we had a very decentralized newspaper system. And you can contrast that with what happened in Britain and France, where in Britain, London totally dominated the press, and in France, Paris totally dominated. And those patterns stem from policies that those governments followed. This goes back to the 17th century and even earlier. They created a monopoly of printing in their capitals so that they could keep a close eye on what was printed. And the result has been a persistent pattern through history of a high degree of centralization in communications in Britain and France. So we started off on a different road. We created a more decentralized press. We still, I mean, there's been certainly a lot more concentration in the press since the early Republic. But actually, we do have a system that is still more local in control than the Europeans have. With all the, you know, growth of mergers and acquisitions, there still is an important legacy, I believe, that was left from this early period in our history. And I think it's also left us a model to look at. I think we don't have to invent something entirely new in thinking about what would be desirable. We can look to our past and see that this worked pretty well.
Our guest again today, Professor Paul Starr. Our phone number, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Starr is the author of the new book, The Creation of the Media. We're talking about it. It's a sweeping overview of the political history of communication and the media system in the United States from the colonial days to 1941. Let's go to our phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Paul Starr. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on, sir.
I have a question for our speaker.
Yes, please go ahead.
You spoke about the influence of the newspapers circulated by the post office and the importance of the post office. My question is, do you have any precise figures, I mean, backed up by evidence, for the degree of literacy? Of course, it was, alas, illegal to educate slaves. And so far as I know, only about 5 to 15% of the population could read or write. Do you have any evidence on that?
Yes. Well, in answering this question, you've already made the crucial qualification, and that is that African American slaves were denied the opportunity to become literate. But the literacy rate among white Americans was, in the early 19th century, probably the highest of any population in the world. Now, there's a very significant north-south difference even among whites, so that in New England, in the upper Midwest, in the mid-Atlantic states, there was a very high rate of literacy, and I do have specific figures in my book. I'm not looking at that right at the moment, so I'm not going to give you the data, but I assure you they are there. And we have a variety of sources for these estimates of literacy. It's a very, very heavily studied subject. One of the things that happened in the late 1700s, early 1800s, is that literacy among young women caught up to the rate among young men. And
that would only be among the ruling class.
No. This is far more general than that. This is far more general than that. The rate in New England, I know, by the late 1700s, was already about 80% literacy among white men. And so you have women catching up to that level. Again, I'm reluctant to quote figures off the top of my head, but it's far more. We're not just talking here about the ruling class. We're talking about something that extended far more generally.
What about working class ghettos in New York City, where you had sometimes three families in a two-room apartment, and very often children never went to school, or they often left school in the fourth grade?
Well, it's certainly true that many immigrants came to America, and you know, were not literate. But also, you need to remember, if we're talking now about the early 1800s, we're talking about a predominantly rural, small-town society where only a very small fraction of people lived in large cities. So I think the image that you have is something that comes from the later part of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for calling in. And if you'd like to call in and join our conversation, Professor Paul Starr, about his new book, The Creation of the Media, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In upcoming weeks, our guests are going to include Bob Jensen, the University of Texas journalism professor, Jeff Cohen, the former producer of The Donahue Show and the founder of the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and Janine Garofalo, the evening host of on the New Air America radio network and a well-known comedian and actress. Professor Starr?
Yeah.
You know, you have a large portion of the book addresses developments in telecommunications, particularly in the 19th century, following the post office, telegraphy and then telephony, the telegraph system and the telephone system. And the title of the book's Creation of the Media, to someone who's not closely acquainted with these issues, they might find it a bit unusual that so much attention would go to these technologies when the book is about media. Can you explain why, what your thinking was?
Well, these were what we might think of today as the national backbone. I'm thinking of particularly the telegraph of high-speed communication. There was a direct link between the telegraph and the news media. And I think this opens up another whole side of the discussion about the problems of monopoly. So the telegraph in the United States started out as actually, the very first line started out as a federal government line. The government subsidized, paid for it, the first telegraph line, the first public telegraph line anywhere in the world in 1844. But for a variety of reasons, the telegraph was privatized thereafter, and we had a highly competitive private telegraph industry. Well, it was competitive for about two decades, and then the entire industry really came under the control of what was, in fact, the first national monopoly in any industry in the United States, and that was the Western Union Telegraph Company. And what was relevant there to the media is this, that the telegraph effectively replaced the post office as the basis of a national news network. After all, telegraph news could move far faster than newspapers through the mail.
Mm-hmm.
And the Western Union Company had an exclusive deal with a group of newspapers that controlled the Associated Press, and no other news service would be distributed. And the result is that a monopoly in the pipeline, as we would say today, created a monopoly over the content. And this was, I think, really the first point in our history where monopoly power in the media asserted itself. And at that point, there was no antitrust law. Americans really had no precedent for dealing with this kind of concentration of economic power. There was a movement to take over the post office, as had happened, for example, in Britain. This is, I'm talking now about the late 1860s, 1870s.
You mean to take over the telegraph system?
I'm sorry, to take off the over the telegraph, right?
And make it similar to the post office.
Yes, yes. At that point, I think that would have actually opened up control of telegraph news, so that other news services besides AP could have been able to operate. But for a period in the late 19th century, we had a monopoly over national news distribution.
Now, if I understand your argument, so in the postal period, the hegemony of the post office prior to the telegraph, these enormous subsidies helped really spawn an array of publications that would have had difficulty existing otherwise.
Yes.
And probably an array of viewpoints that therefore wouldn't have existed otherwise. Then we turn to the telegraph and we have a private monopoly emerge by the end of the Civil War. And it leads to a monopoly in national news through the Associated Press, and only those newspapers affiliated with the AP then are really in a position to effectively cover national news?
Yes, that is exactly what happened.
And that has a narrowing effect on the nature and caliber of journalism in our society.
Yes, yes. And I think, I mean, the telegraph monopoly ultimately did break down with the growth of a telephone network, which was not under Western Union's control, and then later with the development of broadcasting. But for a significant period of time, there was this blockage in national news.
And this is primarily throughout the Gilded Age, what we call the Gilded Age?
Yeah, yeah. And there is evidence that I cite in my book that the 1876 election, which is, some historians would say, a stolen election,
we've never had those in our country, have we? Have we, Professor Stern?
Well.
Maybe one.
In 1876, this was the end of Reconstruction. This was the deal that enabled Rutherford B. Hayes to become president when he had not won the popular vote. The evidence is that the Associated Press helped to manage national news to discourage resistance to this process.
We're talking to Professor Paul Starr, the author of the new book, The Creation of the Media, just published by Basic Books, a sweeping overview of the political origins of the modern U.S. Media system, going from the colonial days through to 1941 and covering all the major technologies. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters and have a question or comment for Professor Starr, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And you've already alluded to this several times, Professor Starr, and in your book you certainly make this clear. I mean, you wrote this book not only to set the record straight about the past, but because of serious concerns you have about media today and going into the future. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Yeah, what are the lessons you think that you'd like people to take from this book as they look at contemporary issues and issues down the road, and what are the issues that you were thinking about?
Well, there are a variety of different concerns. We've already been discussing one of them, which has to do with the concentration of control over the media. And I think this history can be a useful way of looking at some of the choices that we face today. This, of course, has to do with the question of whether the FCC should proceed with the change in the caps on the ownership of TV stations. Unfortunately, in my view, in 1996, Congress eliminated the national ownership on radio stations, and of course we've seen a tremendous increase in the number of stations owned by two companies, Clear Channel and Infinity in particular, but in general a movement toward much more concentrated control over radio. That worries me. And I think a number of other decisions having to do with satellite TV and so forth are also very, very troubling because of the amount of power they lodge in the hands of very few companies. I hope that this history would help people put that development into perspective. And then there's some other things that have to do with the development of the law, and in particular that have to do with the interpretation of the First Amendment. A lot of this book is about free expression and about the institutional basis of free expression. Part of it is about how the courts have interpreted the First Amendment, but a lot of it has to do with the sort of the material and institutional basis of free speech in America. And I'm concerned that increasingly the courts have interpreted the First Amendment as a kind of super property right, so that it's essentially a right of the companies that own the media, as opposed to being a right that is really partly a right of the public to hear diverse views. And I think if you build into your understanding a sense that the diversity of voices in the public sphere is a crucial element in our understanding of the First Amendment, it leads to different results in a number of key areas of the law. So that's another thing that I'm concerned about, that the court has tended to give much more priority in recent decades to commercial speech. It used to be understood that political speech was really the core of the First Amendment, and that we needed the strongest protection for that. The court has been, the Supreme Court has been moving more toward giving priority toward commercial speech, and I think that is not the right way to look at it. So this is these are a number of the issues. There's also a whole set of concerns about copyright. I try to show, and a number of other recent books have done the same thing. Lawrence Lessig of Stanford has been particularly effective in doing this, that the original understanding of copyright was very limited. There was a strong effort to protect the public domain, and to so copyright had very limited application. It had short terms, and over the past several decades, we've seen a tremendous increase in the length of copyright, in the scope of copyright, and effectively now, more and more of our culture is being owned by fewer and fewer companies. And I think that is a real problem for creativity as well as free expression, because so much of what creative people do in the arts and in literature involves transforming the culture that we've inherited. I mean, this goes from Shakespeare, of course, who used plots that were not his own, all the way down to Walt Disney, for example. Almost all the Disney films drew their stories from the existing literature. And now, of course, the Disney Company is one of the most aggressive in asserting copyright rights and in extending the length and scope of copyright.
We're talking to Paul Starr today, the author of the new book, The Creation of the Media. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number again, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Urbana, line one, you're on the air with Professor Starr.
Yeah, thank you. Your guest mentioned that in Europe, the governments were very watchful of what is published, and today, the White House press corps is careful not to ask tough questions in case they're frozen out by people like Karen Hughes. And I was just wondering if you could put Ms. Hughes in context. Is she a throwback, or is this a new development? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I think the White House is always concerned about managing the news. I don't think that's new with this administration. I think they've been pretty aggressive in their use of the powers that they're that are available to them. But I don't know that there's anything that's really a dramatic departure in this area. Maybe it's something I'm unaware of. But I think there's more continuity there.
Professor Starr, one thing I'd like to ask you, you are the co-editor of The American Prospect. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about The American Prospect?
Sure. The American Prospect is a monthly magazine which deals with politics, ideas. It's a liberal magazine. We've always been clear about that. We started out back in 1990. In the wake of the disaster of Michael Dukakis's presidential campaign, when Dukakis had not been really willing straightforwardly to say that he was a liberal,
it was the L word.
Yeah, and we felt that there were a lot of publications that had once been liberal publications that had really grown wary. They weren't willing to serve the traditional purposes that they had served in the past. And so we felt the need to create a new magazine, and my co-founders in the enterprise were Robert Reich, who later became Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, and Bob Kuttner. And Bob Kuttner and I have been co-editors since the magazine was established. We now have a third co-editor, who's the executive editor, Michael Tomasky. And it's we have seen the publication grow. We have a circulation that's now around 55,000-60,000. So it's not a mass market publication, but it's serious, but I hope entertaining political magazine.
And if listeners want to find out more about it, is there a website they can go to?
Yes, www.prospect.org.
Prospect.org. What are some of the cover stories or major stories you've had in the last few issues that to give listeners a sense of, you know, what you're covering and writing about?
Well, we were onto the some of the story that has been in the news lately with Bob Woodward's book because we featured a story called The Shame of Colin Powell just the issue before last, and everything that has come out since has confirmed, I think, that Powell was in fact shut out of the key decision making on Iraq. He disagreed with it, but he nonetheless went along with it and defended it publicly, and so that's an example. We are much concerned with what's happening nationally, internationally, in Iraq, in Europe, elsewhere, as well as with domestic policy, and we try to look at things in perhaps a longer run perspective than the daily papers. We had, for example, a supplement recently on the problems of low-wage America. We have another one in the current issue on the war on the middle class, looking at things, for example, like the administration's attempt to shift taxes from capital, from dividends and so forth, onto labor. And so what we do is to try to connect some of the underlying developments in politics with the issues that are on people's minds.
How would you, taking a longer view analysis of the current administration, how would you compare this administration of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney with that of his father and with that of the Reagan administration? Are they basically similar lineage and more of the same trajectory, or do you think there's a qualitative difference between them?
Well, I think they are the same lineage, but I think this administration has turned out to be much more, has turned out to be much more conservative, has turned out to be much more reactionary than many people might have expected. In terms of foreign policy, the group of people who've dominated foreign policy in the administration have really turned away from the circle that controlled foreign policy in the first George Bush's administration. So while the first George Bush was much more internationalist in outlook, was careful to build coalitions, this group threw all those cautions aside and, for example, has rejected international agreements in a variety of areas, this is long before Iraq, and has pursued a much more aggressive go-it-alone policy. And I think this is very worrisome to many people. Even if I think many centrists are concerned, ought to be concerned about that development. I think the same is true in many areas of domestic policy, relationship between church and state. Let's just take the kinds of questions we're talking about mainly today, having to do with communications. The administration is undertaking a much more aggressive campaign against indecency, there's a lot of people concerned about the coarsening of the culture and so forth. But if Congress passes, and I assume it will, and the president signs legislation greatly increasing the fines on stations for indecency, this will have a chilling effect that goes far beyond what many people have in mind. Because in the case of indecency, we're talking about a very vaguely defined concept. After all, there's a tremendous amount of discussion about sexuality on TV and radio today. exactly where do you draw the line and say this is indecent? It's not clear. So it will only take a few of these monster fines to lead many broadcasters to decide they just don't want to have any discussion at all about some of these topics.
Yeah, we're talking to Paul Starr, the author of the new book, Creation of the Media, co-editor of the American Prospect today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have phone lines open at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Ithaca, New York, welcome to the airwaves of Illinois.
Thank you. I want to ask a question that goes back to the beginning of the conversation today, and it relates to newspapers and the Postal Service. And I know that Benjamin Franklin was both a publisher and the first Postmaster General, and I wondered if you could talk about what kind of role he played in shaping the beginning of the Postal Service and the newspaper business.
Uh-huh. Well, it's true. In the colonial period, Franklin was actually the Deputy Postmaster General for North America, a position he shared for a lot of that period. And he did play an important role in establishing some of the key policies. For example, I mentioned before that newspapers had a right of free exchange, that an editor could send a copy for free through the postal system in exchange for a copy from the other paper. And that was a Franklin innovation. But I don't think really he had that much of a role in the key postal legislation, which was passed by Congress in 1792. I mean, at that point, I think it's really fascinating because you go back to that debate in Congress. Many of the framers of the Constitution were involved, James Madison, for example. And the decisions about the post office reflected, I think, a direct line from the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to what was at that point the key communication network. So it wasn't only Franklin. It was really a set of judgments, I think, that reflected more or less a consensus among the framers.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that jumps out as I read your book and as I've done my own work on related subjects is, the amount of public discussion and debate there were at times on these sort of fundamental issues about setting up a communication system, like you talked about with the mm-hmm. post office. Was there, was there a consensus in your view in general throughout much of American history to promote the institutions that would be the basis of our press system? Or was this at times a topic of fierce fighting among the American people?
Oh, there were fierce divisions. There were major disagreements. I mean, let's go back to the case of the Telegraph that we mentioned earlier. The Telegraph, the electric telegraph, arrived on the scene in the 1840s, and there was a sharp division of opinion as to whether, from the beginning, it should be part of the post office or it should be a private business. And it happens that in 1844, we had a presidential election. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, wanted the government to run the telegraph. The Democratic candidate, James Polk, who won the election, favored a private telegraph. That's not the only reason it ended up that way, but I think that was a factor.
Was that actually a significant issue in that presidential race, so the public was aware of this and talking about it?
No, I don't. I don't want to suggest that it was a big public issue compared to the other things that were on the agenda at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think actually the later battle over what was called postal telegraph, where there were in fact petitions. Supposedly, the Knights of Labor had a petition signed by a million people to nationalize the telegraph. So I think there was a lot of discussion about that at the time. There are other episodes. You've written about radio, I don't want to portray this as all a matter of consensus. I don't think that's right.
But it is fair to say, I think, that, I mean, in general, you think this is something that, is an important part of American history that's generally been positive, the creation of the media, the press system through its history, that's had benefits for the American people and for the Republic. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Well, I think there are two sides to this. I think there is one side of it that has really been an American triumph. Much more rapid development of communications in the United States, very innovative in terms of communications technology. There have been episodes where we have created a very decentralized, lively public sphere. Some things that are really, I think, important benchmarks, important things to hold up as models. On the other hand, there's another side to this too, as you well know from your own work. There have been episodes of repression, in some cases political, in other cases moral censorship. One of the subjects in this book is the whole history of moral censorship in the late 19th century, with Anthony Comstock as a leading figure. This is the other side of the role of the post office.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that in the early republic, the post office was not used for purposes of censorship, but after the Civil War, it was. And in fact, quite a significant control over certain forms of expression, for example, having to do with birth control, that were imposed through the postal system. So, you know, that's the other side of this, and we never should lose sight of that.
We're talking to Paul Starr, author of The Creation of the Media. We have another caller. Let's go line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Professor Paul Starr.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to know if you covered, and I don't actually remember hearing this dimension of early media and telecommunications covered. You had Schiller's biographer on, and I'm sure that must be in Mass Communication in the American Empire, but I think I remember reading it in Barnow that when the early landlines for telegraph went into Central and Latin America, RCA Victor was a major holder, and it was doing it in concert with United Fruit. So what I'm getting at is the way the whole system was set up was, for the corporations, by the corporations, and for the benefit of the corporations right from the very beginning. And people make a big deal out of how the U.S. didn't have a intelligence service, but it was sort of privatized from the beginning because everything that was coming out of Central America and Latin America was pretty well scanned by the people that were owning the corporations, that were owning the landlines, et cetera, et cetera. So things like commodity prices and all that. I mean, it's a dimension of telecommunications that, and the way that it evolved in our backyard, as it were. I don't know if it's germane to your discussion in any particular way or whether you treated it, but
I think
it's an interesting story.
I don't deal with the developments abroad that you refer to, but I'm also reluctant just to say that the corporations dominated everything from the beginning. I wouldn't want to reduce the history to that. I mean, obviously, corporate influence is a significant factor, but it's not the only thing going on. If we go back now to the early republic, there are very important political stakes in communications. The political parties are vitally concerned that they be able to mobilize their followers, that they be able to communicate with them and mobilize with them. So it's not only a matter of economic interests. What I'm trying to emphasize in my book is that there are really important political concerns that have been a factor in the development of communications, and they're not reducible.
Well, I would agree that it's not. I don't want to be reductionist. Yeah. I think it's just the dimension that doesn't get discussed much. We talk about General Sarnoff and his stance and his politics, et cetera. But it seems to me that not to be economic determinist, but that dimension doesn't get investigated much. And that the facts that I gave out, and I think they are documented in Barnow and some other places, are just so blatant that they ought to be involved in the history of uh-huh. the development of telecommunications. And,
sure.
Okay. I don't know if there's another comment from Mr. McChesney on that issue.
Well, I thank you for calling, and I think that there is a global story, and I think you actually allude to it to some extent, Professor Starr, concerning the competition with regard to global telecommunication and at times cooperation between British and U.S. interests,
uh-huh.
Which is crucial, especially with the cables, the
yes.
oceanic cables. We've only got about 8 minutes left, Professor Starr, and I wanted to really talk about, I think, central issues today that I think you've written about in other contexts and at other times, specifically, say, the Internet, which, you know, is a technology which is in a medium that is radically transforming much about the media culture that we have in the United States and the world today. And a lot of people will say, when I talk to students and to people in general, that, you know, these sort of concerns about subsidies and government policies really, as important as they may have been at one time, now are pretty much made irrelevant by the rise of the internet, because this is, you know, technology that basically eliminates concentration, eliminates concerns about corporate control or domination or monopoly, and opens up sort of a level playing field anyone can play on. And that, you know, all we need to do is, once we keep the government out of the people's hair, there's no censorship, everything will work out perfectly. Well, really, we've got the technology now for an ideal media system. Does your book, do you think, support that view?
No, I don't think it does. I think everything that has happened in the last several years indicates that there is going to be a need for much more law with respect to the Internet. There was a delusion, I think, in the early years of the Internet that information wants to be free, that the technology itself would produce a free environment. But there are tremendous problems that people are dealing with today. Viruses, spam, fraud. Many people are concerned about pornography and so forth. All sorts of issues having to do with the Internet. And it is not a realm that is going to be kept completely free of the law. It can't be. And the question is, what kind of law will it be? I think we face really crucial choices here. And so we need to look back at our history and at the kinds of choices that are most likely to lead to free and diverse communications. Also, when you actually look at the data about about where people go on the Internet, there's actually a very significant amount of concentration in a relatively small number of websites. So some of the same patterns are getting reproduced. I think also we shouldn't pretend that the Internet is really just displacing everything else. We have a highly concentrated cable television system. We have a high degree of concentration in terms of the production of programming. If you look behind all those many different channels, what you find is that they're owned by a relatively small number of companies. And in terms of television, for example, in the bad old days, we had three networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, back in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. And people have talked about the emergence of a multi-channel environment with cable and satellite and so forth. But actually, now there are five companies, which I believe have 75% of the primetime TV audience. If they are able to purchase additional cable channels, I saw one investment analysis that said they'd go up to 85% of the primetime audience. That's a very high level of concentrated control over the programming that people actually see.
If I can add to that, just to supplement that, these five companies, unlike the three in the 1960s, also own all the major Hollywood film studios.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they have additional power in that regard, too. What would you say, Professor Starr, you know, someone listening to this, they'd say, well, what can I do? What issues should I be working on? Where are the areas that we should be moving forward and really trying to alter the way the system's working to improve it? Are there things that you recommend to people?
Yeah. This, by the way, is outside the scope of my book, but I'm glad to talk about it. I actually think there is a chance to limit this trend toward greater concentration. In connection with the battle over the FCC moves, there was support from both conservatives and liberals for cutting back on the number of TV stations that a single company could own. I think there are conservatives who are also concerned about this trend. After all, you know, they don't especially like Hollywood. I think there's a potential here for coalitions that cross the usual ideological lines. And that, to me, is one basis for hope that we could do things that will help maintain greater diversity in the media and in our public life.
Do you get any sense that politicians today are interested in taking up an issue like this, much like, say, James Madison was willing to do or Henry Clay was willing to do, you know, in years gone by?
Well, there are some. I'm not as optimistic about that because this is a longstanding problem that political leaders are dependent on those very media companies to get their message out. They want coverage. They want positive coverage. And so it's difficult to get them to stand up to those forces.
Professor Starr, we've only got 2 minutes or so left. And I did notice that you dedicated the book, if I'm not mistaken, to Daniel Bell.
Yes.
And maybe you could just tell our listeners who Daniel Bell is, or was, and
he is, and
why you dedicated it to him.
Yes. Well, I dedicated it to him, frankly, because he was a teacher of mine who had considerable influence on me. He's the author of such books as The Coming of Post-Industrial Society and many, many other books and essays over the years. He encouraged a kind of sociology that is no longer, I think, so common in the field. And that is one that looked to the big picture, that tried to identify the underlying forces in a society that was not caught up in small-scale questions. And it's partly, that inspiration that led me to dedicate the book to him.
So that approach in sociology that is not that common today?
Well, it depends. I don't want to suggest I'm the only one. There are certainly others who do it. But there is there's certainly a strong current in the field that encourages people to work on testing very specific, quantifiable hypotheses. A great deal of good work of this kind is done. It's just not my style, and so I dedicated the book to Daniel Bell for that reason.
Well, I want to thank you, Paul Starr, the professor from the Sociology Department at Princeton University, and the author of the new book, The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications, just out from Basic Books, and a book that I can guarantee you will be a foundational work in media studies and in political discussions about media for years and years to come. Professor Starr, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
And I'm Bob McChesney, your host of Media Matters. We'll be back 1 week from today with Bob Jensen on our show. And coming weeks after that, we'll have Jeff Cohen and Janine Garofalo. Again, on behalf of Victor Picard, my producer, I want to thank you, the listeners, for the phenomenal support you've given both WILL AM 580 and, in particular, Media Matters last week in the pledge drive. And we're going to be here for the next 51 weeks till the next one, or actually 25 weeks, delivering more of what we've been doing. So thank you again. See you in a week. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Amisong, presenting their annual spring concert, The Message of Music, on Saturday, May 1st at 8 p.m. and Sunday, May 2nd at 3 p.m. at McKinley Presbyterian Church, 809 South 5th in Champaign. Both concerts will be interpreted for the hearing impaired and are wheelchair accessible.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy and breezy, the high in the mid-60s, holding nearly steady or slowly falling, with southwest winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low in the mid-40s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the lower 60s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour in the morning, increasing to 15 to 20 miles per hour in the afternoon. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.